You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
Lauren, I wish I didn't have to have you on the show. We were just talking before we hit record, and I've spent some time with you and Keone over the years, and it was clear to me that you guys liked staying out of the limelight and just putting your heads down and working on Samurai Wallet, and you've been thrust into the public eye as you are forced to fight for the freedom of your husband. And yeah, I've been thinking about this interview for a few days now, and it's like where to start. And I guess the best place to start is, how are you? How has this whole process been for you?
Hi. Well, first, thank you for having me on, Marty. As you said, we have known each other for a while, so you know, it's nice to be speaking to, you know, kind of a friend in that sense. But yeah, I'd rather not be here. I'd rather not be in this position. It's hard. It's hard to wake up and not have my husband here and not have, you know, the person I would turn to ask advice on kind of these speaking matters or what to say or how to, you know, keep fighting for him. And I can't ask him. I can't turn to him. I can't message him. I have to wait for, you know, when he can call from prison. And that's a difficult position to be in. But I'm also grateful that people like you are allowing me a platform to talk about the real injustices of this case and the fact that we're still here and still fighting. So his kind of memory and, you know, him as a person isn't dying on the outside, that people can know that this is still going on. So thank you.
No need to thank me. We've been in this battle together for many years before even the case began, because I think what Keone, Bill, and others who are being persecuted right now really fought for is something that I deeply believe is a human right, which is the right to privacy, and in this case, financial privacy. I think Matt Odell says it best. You can't have freedom without financial privacy. It is a prerequisite. If you want to build wealth, you need to be able to do that in a way that protects your privacy. And that's why we supported Samurai Wallet on Rabbit Hole Recap via 1031 for many years, because it's something that we truly believe in. And it's crazy that we live in a time where it is looked at as something that is dirty, that you shouldn't want to find. And as we accelerate toward the AI future, where it seems like the digital panopticon can get even stronger, it's incredibly scary that you have freedom fighters fighting for the right to privacy being thrown in a cage.
And so much of this is just, you know, obviously it's been ramping up, and as you know, so rightly pointed to the potential with AI, but a lot of this came about in the 90s and then the early 2000s with the Patriot Act. Like, this in our lifetime has massively ramped up, this attack on privacy. And, you know, you said you can't have freedom and liberty without privacy, financial privacy. And, you know, that also goes to speech, you know, speech transactions, who you interact with via your money is a form of speech. And so it just affects so much of the founding principles of this country. And yeah.
Was this a topic that you and Keone bonded over, or was this something that you came to learn just via osmosis by hanging out with him?
I was definitely in the libertarian leanings when we met, but he's, you know, brilliant. And I definitely have learned a lot from him over the years. Yeah, but I think I had that kind of, I think that's something that bonded us initially, that we had those similar sentiments.
Yeah. How is he doing?
It's hard. I mean, thankfully he's safe. He's not in a like dangerous place, but at the same time, it's prison. He doesn't deserve to be there. It's unjust. Like yesterday. So the way prison works is you have a certain amount of minutes in a month, and that's capped. So you kind of have to budget those and kind of say, okay, so we're going to call for this many minutes a day so that we can talk. And usually we have a 6 a.m. call. And that didn't come. And by like 10:30, I was getting really anxious because it, you know, it's been hours. So I called the prison and they give some nondescript BOP answer that, yeah, he's there and he's well. Not sure what that means, but, and then it was hours later. And then finally he was able to call, and there had been a system-wide outage for the emails and the phone system. But my mind obviously goes to, okay, well, as the time ticked on, you know, worse and worse case scenarios. Is he injured? Do they not know he's injured? Is, you know, did something happen? Like, so while it is safe and thankfully he's fine and it was just a technical issue, those feelings are always on my mind. It's also for his side, for someone who was building something that he loved and believed in for, you know, a decade and really putting his, you know, heart into it, you know, way more than 40 hours a week, right? Like that's what he breathed was building Samurai Wallet and kind of what was the ethos behind that. And then, so to have that stripped away as well, it's very difficult for, I think, anyone who is a contributing member of society to be thrown into a cage, which really you're, you know, boredom is what gets you, the monotony of day to day and just trying to, you know, when hours stretch in and they feel like a week, like it just really kind of grinds you down. So while he's fine, it's, and you know, he'll get through it. It's still not a good place.
Yeah.
It's still prison.
Yeah. I mean, and you're in a prison of your own, right? Even though you're out here, it's, I mean, like you just described, you don't have your husband there to answer questions. And that can be a mental prison. Like you said, the worry that you had when you didn't get the 6 a.m. call. And that's like the most disheartening thing about all this is the collateral damage for you and everybody else, the chilling effect that spread across the industry. And when you get down to the brass tacks of it, I mean, it seems clear to me that what the DOJ was charging Keone and Bill for was not legitimate. I mean, as defined by FinCEN when they went to ask for an opinion, what was it, 3 or 6 months before they actually charged them?
Six months. And yeah, and that's right. The regulator who's under Treasury, who's mandated by Congress to actually enforce these laws. And there's just so many, and that's, you know, that's a Fifth Amendment violation right there, right? And you can't just change, you're not supposed to just be able to change the law or interpretation of the law and charge people without any kind of notice. But that's exactly what they did in this case. And just kind of time after time, how much the system has failed in our case. And again, it's, you know, as much as like, obviously, you know, I care because it happened to me, it has opened my eyes to that this is kind of prolific in our system, unfortunately, that especially in kind of these white collar cases, there are some that I'm sure are just, but a lot of them are these twisting effects. And, you know, the way the U.S. law is written is it's supposed to be that if there's any ambiguity in the law, it's supposed to go to the side of the defendants. So, you know, if let's say, and I don't think it was, I think it was clear cut, you know, when the regulator themselves are saying, as you said, you know, that they did not break a law. But let's say there's somehow ambiguity in that, it should have still sided with us. And it didn't. And, you know, every step of the way, the particularly, you know, our judge, like just not even hearing arguments on it, just denying all motions. And it's just, it's really, it's hard to come to terms with, because in my opinion, you know, we no longer live in a free society if this is the case, if they can on a DOJ's, on a prosecutor's whim, just decide that the law that you've been operating under for 10 years is doesn't matter anymore, and they're going to charge you and ruin your life anyways, and ruin your loved ones' lives.
Yeah, and that was, I mean, talking about Keone last fall, that was the crazy thing. The SDNY particularly seems to have a particular perspective on what statutes they can abuse in terms of not playing by the book. And I think that was the other interesting details. The judges switch midway through the trial, right? And you attempted to say, okay, we got a new judge, let's try to have a conversation. They completely stonewalled you.
Yeah, those, it was actually just so our first judge we had for over a year, and the way he operated his court is he wanted all these big motions and to have one at the same time and then have one large hearing. It would have been our first real large hearing in front of him where the motions would be argued and then he would take his time and decide on it. So we had presented, I think there's probably over six different motions to him. And then 3 days before we were supposed to appear in front of him is when we got the change of judge. So she only had 3 days to review pages and pages of documents, get familiar with the case, get familiar with obviously a complex topic such as Bitcoin and CoinJoin. And, you know, these judges are supposed to be experts in the law. They can't be experts in everything kind of case that comes before them. But apparently she thought that she was enough. And, you know, I would say there was bias, but, you know, that's my opinion.
And I mean, I imagine there are people who are listening to this who are unfamiliar with the Samurai case. I think maybe now it's important, since we're alluding to particular details of the case and the charges, maybe from your perspective, explaining exactly what happened in terms of what they were charged with and where the judge fell afoul in her ruling and her view of what actually what Samurai Wallet actually was at the end of the day.
Yeah. So again, Samurai Wallet was a non-custodial open source Bitcoin wallet, like any other wallet. What differentiated them was they had some added, again, non-custodial, but privacy features built on top. They operated for 10 years and were developing this and were operating under guidance put out by the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, FinCEN, who's, as we said earlier, the regulator in charge of MSB money service business and money laundering. Like they kind of anything to do with finances, they're the regulator that implements those regulations and laws. And so they're following guidance and building their tools and going around, you know, continuing on for 10 years. And on April 24th, 2024, we were raided, a simultaneous raid at our home here in Pennsylvania, as well as Bill's home in Portugal. It was a simultaneous, like, international coordinated raid. The millions of dollars they must have put into that when they could have just, again, messaged our attorney and said, hey, we want to talk to you. This was our first interaction. They never kind of sent letters saying, what information do you have? Can you help us? Don't destroy evidence. Like, there's all kinds of procedural things that they would usually do, especially if it was an entity that was supposed to be regulated, like a bank or something. They don't just, you know, raid their CEO's house. And so that's where it started. And we've found out that they were charging with two conspiracy counts, one conspiracy to operate an unlicensed money transmitter business and conspiracy to money launder. And, you know, a lot of much smarter people than I have gone into this and kind of explained why these really has no standing. But basically, it didn't matter. When they get you in their sights, they go full steam ahead. And, you know, it didn't matter that, as you said, 6 months prior to indictment, they asked the regulator whether we were in violation of these, whether Samurai is in violation of these regulations and laws. And they said no, they brought charges anyways. And, you know, these cases kind of go back to in the 90s, we had the Bernstein that went to the Supreme Court and determined that code is speech. The code you put out is speech. And then in a more recent case about a month ago, another Supreme Court ruling where an ISP was found not liable for copyright infringement committed by their users, even though they knew that these users were violating copyright laws. So the fact that, I mean, to me, that's applicable to this, right? You're saying that the tools put out, the code written, that users did things, and it was a small percentage of users that claim we never actually got far enough to try to analyze to see if their numbers were accurate. But by the government's own numbers, they were only claiming, I think, under 10% of users as being having funds from ill-gotten gains. And, you know, we're not and never were in support of criminality or scams, but that's just a fact of any open technology, the internet, messaging apps, Bitcoin as a whole. Unfortunately, if a tool works, criminals will use it. And kind of lost my train of thought, but that's what they were alleging, that they, knowing that criminals could potentially use the tool, was enough to charge them with a crime, even though they had never had any interaction. There was never communication with any criminals, obviously, because they wouldn't have charged conspiracy charges at that point. They said the conspiracy began when they decided to code the wallet, to create the wallet. So it really is an attack on code and therefore speech.
Yeah. And I mean, just the nature of it all, it's very enraging when you think about the simultaneous no-knock raids, like literally showing up with military grade equipment when they could have easily reached out to your lawyers to say, hey, we don't like what you're doing. Like we need you to answer some questions. And then you think about just the two-tiered justice system that exists when you think about the big banks and all the fraud that they've knowingly enabled. I mean, we can talk about Jeffrey Epstein and Deutsche Bank and JP Morgan and the fact that when it gets found out that they were knowingly aiding and abetting that particular individual, and they get slapped on the wrist with a fine that is just the cost of doing business when people like Keone and Bill were not doing anything close to that in terms of coordination with actual criminals.
On top of that, they, you know, had OXT, which I think a lot of people forget, which was a platform for average people to be able to use the powerful tools that someone like Chainalysis has. And there were many times where they helped Bitcoiners who had been, you know, robbed or scammed to help trace their funds at no cost to the user, just because it's the right thing to do. So these aren't, in no way were they encouraging or, you know, crime. They were trying to help victims of crime. And again, just another tool that was taken off the board for average people, for victims. And it was stripped away and taken down along with the rest of the servers.
Yeah. OXT was a great tool. I remember back in like 2018, I think, Laurent, I think it was before Samurai Choir at OXT, but I remember hopping in there with Laurent and doing an analysis on the dust spamming attacks that led up to the Fork Wars in 2017. It was just like an incredible tool how detailed it got. But I think the fact that they came down with the hammer was, I mean, the no knock raids really gets to me personally, because it's like, number one, you didn't have to use that much force. You have to, I mean, sure, you were scared shitless while it was going on, middle of the night. And it's very clearly a bully tactic to say, hey, we can't have this. Like, we can't have individuals using these tools to attain privacy. We need all the information. We need to be able to tag and bag every single person as they're transacting online, which is a very, very scary thought that is the position of the government or Department of Justice, at the very least, is that no common man, like, you can't do that. You can't have privacy. We need everything. And then you think of all of the waste and overt fraud that exists in the government, and it's exhausting at a certain point. It's like, hey, I'm just trying to live my life, to save and spend in a money that I deem to be superior to the dollar, and for that thought crime of thinking that I should be able to use this alternative currency and payments rail, and not only that, but do so privately. It's frustrating for those of us who are freedom oriented, knowing that just by trying to get a little taste of freedom in our financial lives, that they will come down with the force of guns and military equipment to send a message to the rest.
Originally, they came after Bitcoin, and they didn't like Bitcoin. You know, back in, we can kind of call back to there, and then I think they came around and realized, like you're saying, that Bitcoin without privacy is the perfect panopticon, and so how can they use that to their advantage? And that's to scare development, because it wasn't just about us, although, you know, it was, and they took Samurai off the board from people to be able to gain some privacy, but you have legal protections in the legacy system, or you're, you know, supposed to, where people can't just look into your bank account. They're supposed to get a warrant, or there's some third party doctrines that kind of ease that. But there's restrictions. With Bitcoin, you don't have that. And with Samurai, you got just that transactional privacy back to protect yourself, to protect your loved ones. Unfortunately, we see year on year a ramp up of attacks on people because something gets leaked or traced that they might be a large holder of Bitcoin. And it's just like, it was really just providing tools to give basic levels of privacy, and they've scared, I think, the market away from working on that, which was the desired outcome. And it has so many implications for each and every person, each and every user of Bitcoin. It's a scary thing to think about.
Oh, it is. I mean, just look what's going on with the $5 wrench attacks in France. Not only France, I mean, France is drawing the focus of many people because the numbers are astounding. And it's due to the lack of privacy the French citizens have, particularly as it pertains to Bitcoin ownership. They're forced to declare it to the government on their tax forms. And then those tax forms are public. And so you have a list for criminals who are willing to break the law to physically harm people to steal their Bitcoin. You basically just hand them over a list of targets that they can begin to pick off. And it's insane that this is not recognized by the government as a physical security issue. And I think, to your point about what Samurai Wallet built with CoinJoin, Ricochet, Stowaway, all these different tools that made it easier to transact privately. I mean, this is a physical security risk, is if you're going to be using Bitcoin as money and you're interacting with a bunch of random people as you go throughout your day to buy things, like they shouldn't know, they shouldn't be able to receive a UTXO and then basically derive how much Bitcoin you have simply because you're going to buy a sandwich or a grill, whatever it may be. This is like a common sense. Like, there's no reason that when I go to interact with a merchant that they should know how much money is in my bank account.
It's exactly that. Yeah, you're exactly right. And that's when coming after, you know, Samurai and then the repercussions of other companies pulling out of offering their services to Americans. And then, you know, has the implications of the wider world, right? What policy is set here dictates to other countries as well. And there's a lot of people in other countries that, you know, you mentioned France, but there's dictatorships that their ability to transact privately in Bitcoin is literally a life or death for these freedom fighters. And so it has global implications.
Sup, freaks? This rip of TFTC was brought to you by our good friends at BitKey. BitKey makes Bitcoin easy to use and hard to lose. It is a hardware wallet that natively embeds into a 2 or 3 multi-sig. You have one key on the hardware wallet, one key on your mobile device, and Block stores a key in the cloud for you. This is an incredible hardware device for your friends and family, or maybe yourself, who have Bitcoin on exchanges and have for a long time, but haven't taken the step to self-custody because they're worried about the complications of setting up a private public key pair, securing that seed phrase, setting up a PIN, setting up a passphrase. Again, BitKey makes it easy to use, hard to lose. It's the easiest 0-to-1 step, your first step to self-custody. If you have friends and family on the exchanges who haven't moved it off, tell them to pick up a BitKey. Go to bitkey.world, use the key TFTC20 at checkout for 20% off your order. That's bitkey.world, code TFTC20.
All right, freaks. You know me. You know I don't take sponsor money from products I wouldn't use myself. So listen up. The Aven Bitcoin Visa card is one of the most interesting things I've seen in the Bitcoin lending space in a long time. Here's the deal. You can get a line of credit up to $1 million backed by your Bitcoin without selling a single sat. No games, no annual fees, no minimum draws, and your Bitcoin is custodied by BitGo, which is one of the most trusted names in digital asset security. Aven never lends it out. There's no rehypothecation. You stay in control. And guess what? You can lock in a fixed rate for up to 10 years. That's 10 times longer than most lenders out there, or go interest only for up to 5 years. Rates start at 7.99% APR. For a product that lets you keep your stack and still access liquidity, it's hard to beat. I mean, the duration and the rates is the best I've seen in the market to date. You also get 2% unlimited cash back every time you use the card. Spend fiat, keep your Bitcoin, the whole game. If you've been stacking for years and you need liquidity without triggering a taxable event, this is worth a serious look. Go to aven.com/Bitcoin. That's AVEN.com/Bitcoin. Check it out. Have you become disheartened throughout all this as a reaction? And what do you think the reaction from the overall community or the builders? Because it has been interesting to watch the proliferation of things like eCash, and I think proliferation is a strong word, but I think the maturation, things like eCash, which have a trade-off. You get increased privacy for a custody trade-off. The interoperability between all these second layer networks seems to be increasing privacy, and the advancements are certainly moving forward, and they seem to be relatively under the radar. So I'm actually personally pretty bullish on private Bitcoin usage from a tech perspective. But do you think we're in a sort of quiet lull where the state is just like, okay, we've got a couple examples on the board, we'll lay low and then come down with the hammer later? Or do you think we're actually making progress on getting the message out there that privacy is a human right and we should be able to use these technologies privately?
I think it's a real risk. I think every builder in the space, specifically, you know, you're saying these, and they're, you know, all very, very smart options, these layer twos and different things, but the actual coders are at risk. The precedent this sets, that is, if you're working on something that they don't like, and a user of your software could do something with it that we deem is, bad, that we will come after you. You are liable for the actions of your users. This has implications for miners, for, Lightning Node channel operators, for eCash, whatever they're called.
Mint operators.
Mint operator, yeah. It really does. And, again, outside of the Bitcoin space, which obviously is what we care about, but I think a lot of us probably are using some kind of secured messaging app. And all of these also, if you're writing code, if someone's using your messaging software to plan a bank heist, you're now part of that conspiracy by providing them software. That's what this says. And so as much as I'm hopeful, and it's great to see that there are so many, you and Matt had mentioned one of the panels at the conference about how percentage wise between kind of cypherpunks and, say suits, their percentage might be higher, but the overall number of people working on kind of cypherpunk technology is up. And that's so great. But I do worry that they can come and bring these same theories, these same charges again, and there might be, someone else's wife, and you might have to develop, be interviewing someone else's wife in a couple years when they decide that, okay, these Bitcoiners are still a nuisance. Let's show them a little force again.
Yeah. No, that's something that everybody who's listening should be aware of too. Cause I mean, we may be in a lull in terms of indictments and charges being brought against developers in the space. But if you actually pay attention to what the administration is putting out there, not even the administration, but what's being put in the Genius Act, Clarity Act. And I think the smoking gun in terms of the long-term trajectory of where just the government, I won't pick on an administration, but I just think the federal government in general wants to go. But if you look at the crypto brief that was released last July, I mean, they explicitly say that they want to expand the Patriot Act to include digital currencies, which would preclude that open source software developers try to embed KYC AML compliance into their projects, which is number one, a non-starter, number two, technically infeasible. If it's open source software, anybody could fork it and take out the KYC AML compliance.
And not to mention pointless, as we've seen, since the Patriot Act was introduced, that, criminals will find a way, and it's only hurts law abiding, your average citizen. And those are the only people that are hurt, the people that are willing to follow these laws and give their selfies with their IDs. And then to have that data stolen.
Yeah. And then on top of that, the physical risk, not only the data stolen, but the data used to locate you in meat space and hold you at gunpoint to steal your Bitcoin. And it's not only Bitcoin, right? I mean, credit fraud, all of that, steal your credit card information and put you into insane amounts of debt and force you to go through the legal system to try to prove that, hey, this wasn't me that spent this money. It is completely ineffective. I think the data as of 5 years ago, I think it's the last time I checked, but I think if you're looking at, if you're trying to be objective of the adequacy of KYC AML compliance laws, I think something like 0.01% of money that was deemed to be laundered was actually prevented by these KYC AML regulations. And that's what I worry about, is like how much of a sunk cost. It is a massive sunk cost fallacy, because when was the Patriot Act passed? 2002, 2003. We're 24 to 23 years into this, and it's just become the water we swim in, is that we're all expected to just comply and give up all this information. And time again, literally every week now, there's another hack of a database that leaks sensitive personal identifying information to the dark web and just increases the physical attack surface of everybody that is interacting with products and services that demand this data.
Yeah, this is something that, Keone and Bill were so passionate about. And so, again, their life work that they put in to try to help people and protect people from this. That was a big reason. It wasn't, you know, that as much of the reasons they didn't take KYC was, and they built their software so that they weren't required to by the regulation. They stayed within those bounds, was so that they wouldn't have that data for someone to steal. They didn't want to have that responsibility because it's a grave responsibility that I think a lot of these companies don't take seriously enough. And because, you know, you get data breaches and it's kind of, sorry, you know, sorry this happened to you, good luck. And there's still people getting, you know, emails and getting scammed from data breaches that were almost 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah.
No, and it's like, what? Now we're gonna, now you got Marty Jones coming out. Like, what does the government exist? Like, what is it supposed to exist to do at the end of the day? It's supposed to be, as the founding fathers laid out, it's supposed to be a very small surface area, just an agreement between the states and the federal government. Okay, we'll protect you. At the end of the day, at the brass tacks, it's like, hey, we will provide protection for the states when need be and help coordinate interstate commerce. And they're not, I think it's become abundantly clear, at least in our lives as millennials, that a lot of the actions that the government takes makes our lives worse off, whether it's taxation, you look at healthcare regulation. I think it's become pretty clear that that the American Care Act has increased healthcare costs significantly. If you look at where tax money is being funneled to these Medicaid and Medicare projects that are just being raided by overt fraudsters who don't seem to be getting reprimanded for that. And then obviously you have the money printing aspect where most people, 99% of people, I would say, are just regular common man people who just want to work a job, build a family, live somewhat comfortably. And the government in its current form seems to make that harder and harder to do. They want more of your money. They want more of your liberty. And it just forces you to ask the question, like, what are we even doing here? Why does this thing exist? And going back to, like, it's just the water we swim in. When do people sort of come to the surface and say, hey, I don't like this water. It's pretty filthy. We need to change something here.
And I really hope, and I think that people are starting to kind of wake up to that, at least, you know, what you said, like the fraud that we've seen being exposed by citizen journalists, the American, you know, from the American government, or how they haven't been holding up their end of the bargain, we'll say, for, you know, not doing the responses that they should or that they're expected to. And, you know, it goes back to the old saying, one of the scariest phrases you can hear is, I'm from the government and I'm here to help. And that's, you know, in our case, right, they, part of the end result of this is there was a forfeiture of the website and the app and stuff, but the government then allowed the website to lapse and some scammers reset up the Samurai website, probably to try to commit some kind of scam on innocent people. And that was forfeited to them. That was their property to protect and protect the American people and people at large, right? That's why they took over. Had it remained had it not been forfeited, I'm sure, you know, we could have kept it up and it wouldn't have been offering anything, but at least it wouldn't have fallen into the hands of scammers. And that's just like another way that there were no victims in this case. They never pointed to any victims because what they were saying, it was a compliance violations. But there were real potential victims as a result of actions that the DOJ took.
That's comedically poetic. That, I mean, they're, I mean, from a dollar amount, I think, I mean, who knows exactly how much money flowed through that, but to be very clear, like, even if it was a dollar, like, more people were harmed directly or scammed directly from the DOJ lapsing there than Keone and Bill actually running the service itself. It's laughable. And it is funny because I don't know if you can tell, but a bit of apprehension in my voice right now, because like in the back of my mind, I'm like, I don't want to piss the government off by saying all this stuff. And it is that chilling effect that exists. It's like the act of even highlighting these very clear and absurd realities, just the chilling effect is real. Where it's like, oh, am I going to be put on a list now for saying that I don't like this? And I'm probably already on all the lists, but it's still, it's like, the self-censoring is real. And that's, again, going back to the point of like, what are we doing here? What is the water that we're swimming in? I think anybody listening, it's important to ask that question. Like, should we be afraid to even talk about this? Because not that I'm afraid, but I'm a bit apprehensive to really go full bore into what I'm thinking right now.
I mean, so much of what they used in the case as quote unquote evidence against, again, conspiracy charges. So they're trying to, the government pulled out posts, public posts and other comments taken out of context, but it was all speech that they had, you know, typed or written. And most of it was twisted in some way to say something that really wasn't the intent. And if you knew either of the guys or interacted with them, you could see where they were being facetious or, you know, humorous or whatever. But it's true. And people say, well, they shouldn't have said that. Well, okay. They're operating within the bounds, again, of laws and regulations. Had they not been, I'm sure they would have been watching what they say. If you are a criminal and doing criminal things, you would not be going around and, you know, trying to say things that might be, as you said, challenging. You'd probably watch what you say. But unfortunately, I think this case shows that everyone needs to kind of be watching what they say, because they could take something you said in a chat 10 years ago to a buddy and use it to throw you in jail.
What's up, freaks? This rip is brought to you by our good friends at CrowdHealth. I've been a happy CrowdHealth member for almost 5 years now. My wife and I have had 2 children while we've been on CrowdHealth, and I actually just got the last bill for our third child funded. It was $6,157. CrowdHealth negotiated down to $2,309, and we only paid $500. The rest was crowdfunded by the CrowdHealth Network. If you're sick of health insurance premiums and having to pay deductibles and getting ripped off at the hospital, join CrowdHealth. It's an alternative way to pay for your healthcare. It's not health insurance. It's crowdfunded healthcare. As you can tell, they negotiate prices for you. You pay in cash. It's much cheaper. Overall, we're much happier. They have incredible perks. Go to joincrowdhealth.com/TFTC to sign up. 5 years on CrowdHealth, not looking back. Joincrowdhealth.com/TFTC. Use the promo code TFTC. Once you set up your account, you're going to get $99 a month for your subscription for the first 3 months.
Sup, freaks. When you take Bitcoin seriously, you start with custody. You want to control your keys, avoid single points of failure, and make sure your savings cannot disappear because you or someone else screwed up. That is what Unchained has been focused on since 2016. Unchained is the leader in collaborative multi-sig custody and Bitcoin financial services that keep you in control. They secure over $12 billion in Bitcoin for more than 12,000 clients. That means about 1 out of every 200 Bitcoin sits inside an Unchained vault. Their model is simple. You hold 2 keys, they hold 1 key. And it always takes 2 keys to move Bitcoin, meaning their single key can't access your Bitcoin on its own. Just resilient, shared custody that gives you institutional-grade security while keeping you sovereign. Unchained also lets you trade straight from your vault, access Bitcoin-backed commercial loans, open a Bitcoin IRA where you hold your own keys, and set up personal, business, trust, or retirement vaults. They even offer inheritance solutions built for long-term hodlers. Or opt for the highest level private client service with Unchained Signature and get a dedicated account manager, discounted trading fees, exclusive access to events and features, and much, much more. If you want a partner that helps you secure and grow your Bitcoin without giving up control, go to unchained.com and use the code TFTC10 at checkout to get 10% off your new Bitcoin multisig vault. That's TFTC10 at unchained.com.
How are you feeling in terms of the progress towards getting a pardon right now? I think there's been a lot of momentum. I've been talking a lot with some people who are working on it, and I think we're definitely getting some attention. There definitely needs to be more attention. I think that's part of the reason I'm bringing you on, is to draw more attention to this, because it is a grave injustice. And any day, any minute that Keone and Bill and others that are in a similar situation for writing open source software, they're sitting in a cage. They need to get out immediately.
Yeah, it's hard. I didn't think it would take this long. I'll say maybe that's naive, but you know, we saw what the Bitcoin community can do when the now president of the United States got on stage at the Bitcoin conference in 2024 and announced he's going to free Ross, and he did. Anyway, there's 35 to 70 million estimated voting age adults within the United States who own Bitcoin. That is a huge voting block. And as we just saw this past week, they're here and they want something from Bitcoiners. They want your votes. They want your donations. They're coming to the conferences. They're talking about it on the floor of Congress about Bitcoin. And the momentum and the fact that we were able to get something done and get Ross free, which I'm so thankful for. I think if we, let them know that this is another cause, we don't want to see Bitcoin developers sitting in prison for non-custodial open source software. And that they need to make this right too, and fix this injustice. And I think it's a powerful enough group to get that done.
Yeah, I think it certainly is too. And that's again, reiterate, I think it would be naive of anybody listening out there who's looking at the proliferation of technologies like eCash, Arc, Spark, Lightning, their interoperability and the advancements that are being made to think that we are in the clear. I think without freeing the political prisoners that Keone and Bill and others, and then not only that, but we need to write into law. Like if you're a developer, it's the precedent is there. Like you said earlier, in the 90s, during the PGP wars, we got it stated by the Supreme Court that code is speech. This is no different, which is one of the most frustrating things is we already have the precedent. It's there. The ability to write software, issue it on GitHub in an open source manner should be a non-starter, like pretty black and white. It is legal. Code is speech. And if we don't free the political prisoners and then enshrine again, unfortunately, it seems like we have to do it again, enshrine the right to develop and program computer software in a way that is deemed speech, that every American citizen and hopefully everyone on the planet should have the right to. We're living with a false sense of confidence. Like I think do not rest on your laurels here, because I think depending on who's in office at any given point in time, the tenor can switch rather quickly. And until we get the political prisoners released and enshrined into law, that it is okay to write code that allows people to use Bitcoin in particular ways that were not out of the clear. Not only that, maybe in a more dangerous position than anybody realizes, because maybe they're just waiting in the tall grass for people to build up enough of a privacy infrastructure to come down with a sledgehammer and say, no, you're not doing this.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we still have people like Senator Elizabeth Warren, who she despises everything. And we have judges. There's a judge within the Southern District of New York, not our judge, but another one of her colleagues that, made a statement shortly after kind of our case that said, Judge Radkoff said he saw no point of cryptocurrencies other than for crime and scams. So these are the people that are kind of lording over us until, like you said, if we need to get some actual protections, even, and this was supposed to be an uplifting speech given by our acting Attorney General Todd Blanche at the Bitcoin conference. But about how it should be safe to develop. You should feel comfortable developing within the United States. But he said, there was one little part that he said about knowing that you can't so something along the lines of develop knowing that criminals could are using your software. Well, anyone, again, as we touched on earlier, anyone developing any kind of software knows that criminals, if it's open source, if you don't have a closed, I don't know, you know, if you can't download it from anywhere, you're distributing software or making software available or writing software with the knowledge that someone could take your software and use it in a way that you never intended. So yeah, I completely agree that we need to keep pushing to have some protections to free the political prisoners left over from the war on crypto. And you know, it's not really over until they're free, and then going further and getting some real protections so that people can develop within the United States and make it, you know, as President Trump said, he wants it to be the crypto capital of the world. Well, you know, there's going to be a real flight of development talent if these things aren't fixed.
Yeah. Like, what if somebody kidnapped somebody and somebody else and they tortured them by playing a song on loop for 120 hours for an extended period of time, and they use Spotify to play that song to torture somebody? Like, is Spotify liable for that torture mechanism? Like, is that a tool of torture right there for some
people? They should have known that if someone's playing a song for 120 hours that, yeah, it should have flagged on their back end, I guess.
Yeah. No, but I mean, just to highlight the absurdity of this all, I mean, if you extend the logic that is being used in the case of Bitcoin privacy tools, open source privacy tools, I mean, I think if you stretch the interpretation of the law far enough, like by, I guess, reductive reasoning, you'd say, well, yeah, Spotify should have known that people are using Coco Melon songs to torture people for 120 hours a week.
Yeah.
But that's the, again, it's the absurdity of it all. What can anybody listening do to help your efforts and the efforts of others looking to not only free the political prisoners, but also make sure that nobody else becomes a political prisoner in the future?
So first, for us, please go to billandkeone.org. That's BILLANDKEONNE.org. There you can find links to sign our petition calling for a presidential pardon, as well as links to donate. Unfortunately, you know, I hate to do this. This is not something I don't think anyone likes to do, but we are, you know, millions, $2 million in debt, legal fees, and to try to kind of continue raising awareness, it does take money. That's just kind of the bottom line of that. But, you know, further than that, if you have connections or ideas or, you know, something, please reach out to me. I would love to speak with you. You can find me on X is probably the best place, or contact me. There's an email address at the bottom of that website. And then, you know, further, like, if this is something that resonates with you, like, your voice is not too small. You know, you can post about it, you can speak about it, you can let your families know, you can contact your representatives and say, hey, you know, you want something from me? We have midterms coming up, and these politicians are out there looking for something from you. It's okay to ask them for something back. And that's to lend their voice as well to calling for an end of this, you know, this war on crypto and free the political prisoners.
Yeah. Just thinking about it, I was doing this last week at the conference for Bitcoin De Minimis Block, spun up this website to easily go to and find your representative and send them a message about that. In the case of pardons, is it just as impactful? Obviously, they're not passing a law, but if we get enough pings to different representatives across the country, then they shoot it up the ladder to the president, like, hey, a lot of my constituents are very worried about these particular prisoners and would like to see them released. Is it basically just a social pressure campaign that eventually you hit a tipping point where it's like, okay, there's enough of a critical mass that it seems pretty clear that these guys were wrongly charged and thrown in prison.
I think it is. You know, the President Trump is, he's dealt with this office that came after us, like the Southern District of New York came after him and his family. I think he, if he was actually presented with the case in front of him, like would definitely see the merits of it and understand it. Because I think he is a fair guy. But it's a matter of, he is the president. There's a lot going on. So it needs to be raised to a level where he, you know, it's on his agenda by whoever that is. You know, I'm sure he has a lot of people working for him saying this is something that matters. So it, that's why, although it is just with, you know, the one person, President of the United States, Donald Trump, to grant the pardon, as you said, I think it is kind of the pressure and the calls to action that this is something, you know, we care about, and we're not just gonna sit silently and, you know, oh, you did one thing for us. And you're talking about de minimis and other things, right? Like, kind of, there's been a lot of promises, a lot of, I think, proposed laws, but, you know, what have you done for Bitcoin lately? And, you know, to me, it's lacking, but
I would concur. I would concur. Yeah. Focus is not where I would like it to be. And last, just to wrap up, there's going to be a ton of people out there say, oh, privacy isn't worth it, or privacy isn't necessary if you have, if you're looking for privacy or doing something nefarious. And I have no sympathy for developers who are writing tools. What would your message be to the the naysayers out there, or the people who don't understand what Samurai Wallet was or why privacy is important in the first place?
First, privacy is important to everyone, whether you recognize it or not. It's privacy is, you know, allowing you as a person, you get to decide. It's not hiding things, but you just get to decide what information you share. It's, you know, back to the classic examples why we have blinds on our windows and locks on our doors. If you come over to my house, I might invite you into my living room, but I might not have you upstairs into the bedrooms, and you're definitely not looking through my underwear drawer. That's privacy. I don't have anything to hide in there, but, you know, I'd rather not have people that I don't know that well in those private spaces. So this is, you know, our finances, as we said at the beginning of this, are indicative of our speech, who you transact with, who you donate money to, what organizations you support, what causes, you know, it's just all of this is indicative to speech and to freedom. If you don't have financial privacy, you can't have financial freedom. And, you know, the way it is today, you need finances. There's very few people who can go, you know, live off grid and be completely private that way. They, you know, it, we have to interact and have a medium of exchange with people. And that's what hopefully Bitcoin will be, you know, going forward. And but you need privacy for that. So that's the first thing. And why you should care. Maybe you don't, you know, at this point, right? We're feeling kind of good in the Western world. But as we saw with COVID and with the trucker convoy in Canada, that can switch where they will cut off your right to interact, to transact. And when you need privacy, you want tools to be there. You might not think you need it now, but there may be a point in time where you need it. And if they've thrown all the privacy developers in prison, it's a lot easier to take away the rest of your rights, just like with guns, right? It's the same kind of the same arguments they used in these cases against us of, well, there's this small percentage of bad actors using this tool. Same thing they use to try to take away Second Amendment rights. And in the countries that we've seen where they do have taken away their rights to bear arms, other freedoms follow shortly after. So, you know, it's really slippery slope. It's kind of, you know, I guess I wish there's another term, but it's something that we need to stay on top of and not let it to continue to be eroded as it has been.
Yeah, that's what I worry about, the complacency. I mean, going back to the Patriot Act, say, we're 23, 24 years into it now, and that's what I worry about, the frogs boiling in water. Like, if we don't stand up for this, I think Bitcoiners, and obviously your husband and Bill being sort of the shining examples of this, of recognizing the slippery slope and this frog boiling in water effect that we're all being subjected to with the KYC AML compliance and the financial surveillance that has been erected around us over the 21st century. If we do not push the tide in the other direction and use the tools that give us the ability to do that, which Bitcoin, I believe, is the strongest tool to do that. Like, you don't have to ask permission. You can build build on the protocol, and the protocols being built on top of it without needing to go to the government and get a license or ask permission to open a bank account. You can simply download software and access this network. And it is an incredible tool to push back against the encroaching surveillance state that is only getting stronger as time goes on. And if we don't act intentionally and with a sense of urgency, we could wake up in the not too long future and find that we've lost all of it. And getting it back at that point will be a much harder task than it is today. I think whether or not you're recognizing it or you're just simply somebody who goes about their day, you go to your 9-to-5 job, you work at your desk, you come home, you do homework with the kids, maybe you open a beer or you watch a basketball game and you think, I don't need any of this. I'm fine. I'm not operating outside the lines of what the government deems is appropriate. Like you said, that can switch on a dime. And if the panopticon is sufficiently robust and resilient, you could wake up one day and say, hey, you know what? We're going to need you to stay in your house for a while, and you can't go to your job anymore. And oh, by the way, if you do want to go outside, you need to get this injection. I mean, that's already happened. I think a lot of people woke up during that. But again, going back to how the state, or these forces, who knows if it's the state itself or the conglomerate of supranational powers that really have control, but what doesn't really matter at the end of the day. They are slowly but surely taking ground, establishing precedent, lulling people into a false sense of security, and then waiting a couple years and then taking some more ground, establishing more precedent. And you may not feel that it's worthwhile to speak out or to act in a way that pushes back against this, but I would just caution that you may want to start thinking about it.
So when the kind of reporting laws, so when third-party reporting laws, when banks had to start reporting on suspicious activity, it was $10,000. And that the reason they said it that was because this was such a high number, it would stick out. Well, when they wrote that law, you know, in today's money, that's nearly $70,000. So just by the devaluing of the currency and not ever readdressing that number, and so many laws that they do this, right? They start with, we're just going to tax the billionaires. And then it just happens that it just spreads and it gathers so many more people within their nets, if you will. And that's exactly what you're warning about there, that, you know, this complacency can lead to where everyone is affected.
Yeah. I mean, that's a conversation for another day, but repealing the Bank Secrecy Act is something that should be another priority of Bitcoiners. I don't think we have enough time to tackle that in depth.
Let's get them out of prison first.
Yeah. Let's do that. And then take that ground and then start fighting back, and that getting rid of the Patriot Act and the Bank Secrecy Act, I think, should be two top priorities. Uphill so battle. When, sounds when crazy.
When Samurai was in development, and, you know, early Bitcoiners in general, I think it was so much about, let's root around the state. We're going to kind of follow. They're putting out these laws. Okay, we're going to do something different. But in our case, I think it's a perfect example that the state's not going to leave you alone. If you're doing something that's actually affecting them, they're not going to just ignore you and let you, you know, continue on with your little Bitcoin. Like, if you are actually affecting the state, they're going to and affecting their control, they are going to come after you. So just, you know, as a warning, like this isn't over.
No. And for the girl dads out there listening, like, well, I'm never going to do that. It could come down to like, hey, you want to send your kids to private school? You know, we could wake up 15 years from now and be like, oh, private school's banned. You have to send them to our public indoctrination camps.
There's countries that are trying to shut off homeschooling. So, yeah. I mean, that's very real.
Yeah. Lauren, you're incredibly strong, incredibly brave. I know it's been difficult for you to be forced to be out here and doing this. I know for sure that you would rather be doing anything but this, but I highly commend you for doing it. And I think it's good to know that there's strong women and strong wives out there that love their husbands and the ideals that they fought for enough to get out there. Cause I know many, many others would crumble under the pressure. And so I just want to, again, commend you, because I think you're incredibly strong and it's incredibly important what you're doing.
Thank you. You know, Keone actually said before he went in that even though knowing that if there wasn't someone speaking, that he would, all the momentum he had gained in that last little bit where he could speak for himself would be lost. But he said, like, I didn't have to do this. I didn't have to come and kind of put myself out there, because it is a vulnerable position to be in, to speak about things that are personal, that I care about, that affect, you know, us in a very real way. And, but I couldn't not. I knew that if the positions were reversed, and there's so many times that I've, you know, told him, I wish they were, because I think, you know, he would have just been so much better at this than I am. But I know he wouldn't have stopped, wouldn't have given, you know, given up anything to see me released if I was in unjustly. So, you know, I couldn't not. It's he's my best friend and my husband, and, you know, it's partner and everything. So thank you.
Freaks, go to billandkeone.org, support the efforts, reach out to your representatives and make some noise. Keep the noise up. That's the one thing. We had a lot of momentum at the end of last year, leading up to the beginning of this year, and I think it fell off a bit, but we need to get back on the train and make sure that this injustice this wrong is righted, if you will. And we'll keep pushing on our end here. If there's anything we can do, Lauren, please let us know. And I'm optimistic. He's going to get out. Bill's going to get out. Then we're going to reset and then begin taking the ground that we need to take to make sure that this never happens again.
Thank you. Marty for some political office? Is that you're saying?
No. Okay. Maybe. Probably not. Probably not. Too much social media baggage that they'll pull up and point out for office. Okay. F5.
We'll end it there. Sorry. Okay. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you. Peace and love, freaks. Okay. Thank you for listening to this episode of TFTC. If you've made it this far, I imagine you got some value out of the episode. If so, please share it far and wide with your friends and family. We're looking to get the word out there. Also, wherever you're listening, whether that's YouTube, Apple, Spotify, make sure you like and subscribe to the show. And if you can leave a rating on the podcasting platforms, that goes a long way. Last but not least, if you want to get these episodes a day early and ad-free, make sure you download the Fountain podcasting app. You can go to fountain.fm to find that. $5 a month gets you every episode a day early, ad-free. Helps the show, gives you incredible value. So please consider subscribing via Fountain as well. Thank you for your time. And until next time.